bunch of mental guesses of known speech syntax as to what word he most likely spoke in that particular portion of the sentence. And you got to do all this mental processing to figure out what he just said to you. You have a half hour or an hour and a half CUSO under those conditions, and you don't quite realize why you've got a headache at the end of that hour, and you don't know where it's coming from. So good audio is definitely worth fighting for, in my opinion. Maybe that helps somewhat, Rich. Here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Oh, I agree. And rather than have Ed work with a carbon mic and a power supply like he's trying to do, what do you think if he worked with the earpiece, which is exactly what you were describing? He would probably have more success with that, because that's a magnetic with a coil and a diaphragm, and it. What do you think about that, Dick?
That can work like a charm and give very high performance, but there's a catch. The earpiece is made to go into a chamber. The chamber with the earpiece portion of the telephone is made to cup the human ear. And by way of the cupping of the human ear and the chamber that's created there, you end up with a fairly flat frequency response between the electronics and the human eardrum. You put a human mouth and lips in front of an open-circuited earpiece and use it as a microphone. Your frequency response is going to be very different, but it's very correctable. If you own one of those equalizing networks, which has got a bunch of slide controls to it, where you can boost and buck the low-frequency, medium-frequency, and high-frequency components, you can make that into a very high-quality system. But if you use it bare bones, because it was designed for a very different mechanical environment, I'm a little bit worried that what you're going to come out with is a very tinny-sounding, very tubby or very tinning-sounding audio if you don't do some speech correcting, some equalizing. But I know of people who have done that equalizing, and when they do it correctly, they can sound like a broadcast studio, if you know what I mean, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I had to work with throat mics at one time, and they are terrible. So carbon-based ones are just not for me. I don't like the way they sound, but I'm sure Ed will have an interesting project to work on. He'll probably be better off just go out and buy a microphone, but he's interested, and he's working on it. That's about it from Mel's Corner, and we'll pick it up again next week. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, keep those log cards and letters coming. John, do you want to repeat your email web address in case people want to write to you directly to get into Mel's Corner for next week? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Sure, will do. It's Juliet Bravo 5, Oscar, at AOL.com.
So once again, I'm going to repeat that. Juliet Bravo, number 5. And there's two letters after that. Oscar. It's not 00. Oscar, at AOL.com. That allows you to talk directly to KC2WGB and get your beginner's question onto the TechNet next week if John feels that it's a question of sufficient universal value. Now, back in the days that Mel was getting 75 to 300 letters per week, emails, letters, snail mail, and whatever, there were a time when people paid us a very left-handed compliment. They would send us their master's thesis or doctoral thesis in college for review, to be vetted. That's way beyond what we were volunteering to do. There were people who wanted us to redesign a circuit for them. There were people who wanted us to supply very deep kinds of information from time to time. I mean, what's being offered, what the TechNet has offered for 29 years is live, on-the-air, verbal response to people's questions. As you can tell, one-third of all the questions that occur on the TechNet start off with a disconnect. By that I mean, the person poses his question with one set of words, And then by way of the back and forth questions that get asked as to what was the real question, you find out that there was some huge ambiguity. The guy may have asked what sounded like an antenna question, but he was really asking how to get a proper impedance match on the output stage of his transmitter so that the antenna would get a strong enough signal and perform correctly. I mean, there are times when there's a huge disconnect, and when you try to do that in writing, you end up sending letters back and forth, back and forth. When you do it live on the air, and you can hear the guy's speech and know whether or not the two of you are on the same wavelength and understanding each other, the data flows a hell of a lot faster. When I get excited, I can talk 150 words a minute. When I type, I may find in Peck Typer, and I don't know what my speed is, but it's probably 10 words a minute. It's something super slow. And so I can handle very few by typing, and I'm not volunteering to do that. Other people can type a lot faster. If they volunteer and they've got the skill, fantastic. And John has done some of that volunteering, as you can tell. Okay, at this time, if Paul is available, WS2N, our space expert, we'll find out what's the latest with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So if you're the...
Good comment first, Dick.
I'll go right ahead, John, with your comment first.
You know, I have gotten those same requests, and since I put the photos of my lab up there, I even got more, so I know exactly what you're talking about. We spoke earlier during the week. I did send a package to Bernie, so he has two emails from me with pictorials. So when we discuss this, he will disseminate it to whomever. And he's going to set up, he's going to take it from there to set up a site where, when this is done, they'll be able to go there if they wish to and follow along with the diagram. So I just thought I'd give you that advice, and I got the permission from Leslie to do that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Comment?
Yeah, that's very good information, John. Wesley recognized what John is referring to is that for the last few weeks, John, Wesley, Eric, Glenn, occasionally Andy, the three, four, or five of us were discussing a fairly complicated diagram of a circuit that's being studied in Europe for a good fraction of a year, if not longer, which promises some very high performance when it comes to taking a small amount of power and lighting a light bulb. That's essentially what the circuit is attempting to do. And so quite a few hours worth of discussions took place, and people listening late at night, we thought that the machine would ordinarily not be used very much at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, and so this particular group was discussing the circuit and making suggestions as to how to verify what it's doing and how to explain and give hypotheses as to how it operates. But a few people listening were unhappy for two reasons. Let me drop. The two reasons stated were, number one, they didn't have a copy of the circuit, so they couldn't see what's being discussed. And number two, one or two of those people thought that at 11 o'clock at night they would pose a brand new question. They hadn't signed in at the beginning of the TechNet, where we make the promise to people that we'll give them at least a brief answer during the first hour. At the later portions of the TechNet, they wanted to bring up a brand new subject, and from their point of view, we weren't giving enough airspace in between where they could put their edge in word-wise, so to speak, and ask their question. So they weren't happy with the amount of time that was being spent on the circuit that they couldn't see and the fact that they couldn't ask their question. So we're going to try to make corrections of that by letting the circuit be available to people who want to get involved with that operation. And we're going to also periodically ask, is there anyone else with a question? So over to you, Wes, N2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, for the good of the conversation, I decided that I can share the schematic with the audience. As far as the video part of that, I want to keep it private. I believe the audience can stand on the schematic, discuss the schematic, the rest of it is just graphical, it's just, I believe it's too much. Okay, I did whatever I was asked by the members of the board, and that's it. No more. I will share this somatic in the future, but we're not going to extend it. We're not going to make me preparing myself for every conversation, because that would be a duty. That would be, let me drop one. That would be a duty that will I will have to handle. There is none of the members of this club or the members of that of the TechNet who is preparing himself to the TechNet by sharing the information. So I should say yes. If there is any schematic, any link that is gonna take more time, I'm willing to share that link with the audience with no problem. As far as my private video data, I want to keep it for myself and a group of the people that I trust. And to Adrian.
A little more explanation as to what's going on here. Wesley is involved in a kind of a research project involving a number of his European friends, and we're walking a very narrow line as to whether or not the information is slightly proprietary. In other words, as his friends in Europe are developing the working models of these circuits, are they willing to immediately release every one of the fine details as they are doing their investigation to everybody? That's a little bit questionable, and you can sort of understand that. I've been involved in quite a number of patent applications, and I've seen the, if I was going to exaggerate, I would call it paranoia. In some people's minds, when they're developing a patent application and they're trying to explain the theory of operation of a circuit that they have developed, an invention, they want to hold it very close to the chest until the filing has officially taken place. The new rule to the patent office is it's no longer a function of what date it was first entered into your notebook. What really counts now is what date did the application for that invention arrive at the patent office. So some people are real worried about whether or not they've got all their ducks in order and everything written down correctly, and they're not willing to reveal that to the outside world until they get to that point. Some of that is going on, and so you have to be a little bit understanding. There's a couple of people that are a little bit more closely trusted. When it comes to the schematics, I think you can get those. When it comes to the video itself, some of which are on YouTube and some of them are not. These are private pieces of information of the actual operation of the circuit. Let me drop. What Wesley is saying is that he believes that ultimately when the product is developed, because it gives inexpensive energy to a whole lot of people, we believe that it eventually will be revealed to everybody, so to speak, assuming it's successful. And there's not an absolute guarantee of that. And even if there isn't a guarantee of it being successful, still the process of studying, methods of making measurements, methods of making measurements that are quantifiable, traceable to the Bureau, and ready for peer review. There's a whole art and science to doing that. So even if the project is unsuccessful, I mean, as Albert Edison once said, when he was developing that incandescent light bulb, how's it going? And his answer was, it's going pretty well. I know 3,000 things that don't work. I'm making progress. So you got to be careful how you make judgments on these. Now let me find out if Paul is available. WS2N. Paul, are you available for a space report tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet. And the answer might be no. He's one of the more sane people who are honoring the holidays with his family. It's only the crazy people that'll get away from the holiday celebration and trade ham radio information back and forth. I'm going to turn it over to you first, John. What do you believe is the next step that what we should be discussing with reference to the caduceus circuit, I'm going to call it, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I believe Wesley's interest lies in how the coil capacitor actually works. In your opinion, how do you think that coupling is taking place, and also that circumferential foil that's inserted between the capacitance coil and the caduceus coil? what effect that has. And another thing that amazes me, that they put in a, I think it was a 9mm ferrite rod into it, and it doesn't seem to make a difference if it's 1 inch or 9 millimeters, which I don't understand that either. So I checked with Wesley, but I think that's one of the things he would like to do, unless he has something else going right now. Also, he emailed you a picture of the transformer that Glenn was so accommodating the building for him. You may want to take a look at that. I don't know if you did or not, but I'm sure Wesley has questions.
I also put a precise name for each of the of the attachments that I have included, so you should be able to relate on it. Also, the diagrams, the specs of the transformer that Glenn gave me for the Hanukkah present. I believe we have plenty of subjects in this area to discuss. But
the question, Dick.
I received the email that you sent to me this afternoon, Wes. I saw quite a series of beautiful photographs of this four-sided ferrite coil that Glenn wound for you, and he's got a data sheet telling you just about everything you want to know about that coil. So as a step-up transformer, that's what I think its primary purpose is. In other words, it's got a small number of turns in the primary, a large number of turns in the secondary.
The first one is made out of the flat foil.
Ribbon wire.
Okay, the very first photograph of the square coil that I'm looking at, that secondary winding looks like it's an ordinary enameled winding. I think you're saying the primary is a foil type winding with very low series resistance, and I guess that's underneath those windings and underneath that captan tape that I'm seeing. But the main purpose of this transformer, as I understand it, it is a step-up transformer, a small number of very wide foil primary windings, a large number of enameled wire secondary windings, a very high step-up ratio. The ferrite itself, in theory, is a very high-frequency ferrite, so that this transformer, because of its size and the materials being used, is probably subject to very little saturation characteristics until you really push it. So it's not going to saturate. It's got high-frequency response. It's got the voltage ratios you want. So therefore, the effect you're looking for looks like it should be a lot easier to achieve it with Glenn's coil as opposed to some of the ones that you have used in the past. Is that about the way that you see it, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, exactly. It's a 10-to-1 turns ratio from what Glenn told me, and he's going to have that on the output of his Fluke amplifier that he calls the Monster. They're going to use some type of generation going in. He'll put 10 volts basically at whatever waveform he wants, and that will give him from 1,000 volts out of the Fluke into that device, which should generate 10,000 volts on the secondary.
Now, I've got a question for you. And maybe we don't have an answer yet this week, but in the future weeks, if a person wants to see a copy of the schematic diagram and or the photograph of this coil so that what's being discussed, they can also look at it at the same time, do you believe, John, that in the future that possibly can be made available to the listening audience? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Bernie, K2IO, has both of those images that you have. He said he was going to be on board approximately 10 o'clock. I don't know if he's out there, but if Lou or anybody wants that, Bernie can shoot it over to him. It's going to be a little difficult this week, but all of this will be given to Bernie, anything that we're going to discuss, and Bernie will disseminate.
K2YO.
There he is.
Mr. Bernie, you've got the floor.
Sorry, gentlemen, I'm running a little bit late. If anybody would like copies of the information that John has provided to me, go to the QRZ. You'll find my email address on QRZ. Drop me an email, and I'll be at my home QTH in about 8 to 10 minutes, and I will forward them to everybody then. So go to QRZ. You'll find my email address there. Drop me an email saying I want the drawings or I want the documents, and I will forward them to you in approximately 10 minutes.
Sounds awful good, Bernie. My goodness. So on, you're out doing a service call on December 25th. Is that approximately what's going on, Bernie? Wow, are you dedicated.
Negative. I'm out doing family service calls. Had to go take care of family business for the mother-in-law. I will be working on a more automated solution for this in the future, but for tonight, we're just going to manually email forward. But we're working on a similar kind of solution, much to how we have the TechNet for people that want to post questions by email. So we're working on it. John and I spoke this afternoon, and hopefully next week we'll have some answers for you.
Question for Penny.
Yeah, Bernie, when you do set that up so that people can ask TechNet questions, particularly beginning amateurs, have you selected a name for it? It could be called Mel's Corner, the former K2KEY who was doing that for year after year after year. That's one possible name, and maybe you've already got a suggested name. You first, and then turn it over to John. K2YO, K2RIW in the group.
No, I don't have a name, and I 100% support your idea. I think that's a wonderful thing we could do to keep Mel's memory in the process. We do have the email address already at technet@limark.org. I have not received any messages on it, but it is up and working. And so we just want to keep advertising that for all of the folks that are aspiring hams or very young hams or hams that are out of range that would like to send in their questions. And we have a panel of people who are very capable of addressing some of the simpler, more direct questions in real time. And those that we can't, we'll kick up to the TechNet to the Mel's Corner section.
Okay, that web address then is technet@limark.org. technet@limark.org. Okay. You got it, John.
Bernie, is it all right if I give Dick the email address over the air?
Yeah, I guess so, but I assume he's already looked me up. Got it. Dick's a pretty sharp character there.
No, I didn't do it this time. Go ahead, John.
Okay, it's Bernie@huntfamily.com. So if everybody can get ready for that, so when Bernie gets home, he'll put it up there. So Bernie@huntfamily.com.
All right, Bernie@huntfamily.com allows you to make the request to Bernie himself, K2IO, for the copy of the documentations. Now, to get back to your original question, John, without a doubt there is not an easy method of analyzing that circuit. The diodes are charging a capacitor. The capacitor, through the coil of a transformer, is presenting voltage across the spark gap. And when the spark gap does break down, in theory now all of the voltage across that capacitor that has been charged by the diodes is now discharged across the coil of the transformer. That in turn makes a great big spike, which goes to a somewhat similar secondary circuit after a voltage drop-up, a voltage build-up, and that secondary circuit has higher voltage diodes into a capacitor, into another spark gap, and that in turn goes into the light bulb, and one lead of the light bulb goes to this rather unusual capacitor, which is just a curved sheet of metal against the coil. So it's kind of a stray capacitor, and that would lead you to believe that that would lead you to believe that the secondary spark gap voltage that's oppressed across the light bulb is probably an extremely nonlinear spiky waveform. And I think in the past weeks we've heard Wes describe to us the fact that you can put your fingers across the terminals of a light bulb that ordinarily has
90,000 volts.
Yeah, but 240 volts is the normal voltage that goes on the light bulb. So a light bulb that would give you full brilliance at 240 volts is giving at least partial brilliance, 60 or so percent brilliance, maybe 80% brilliance, with people's fingers across it, and the people with their fingers across it are not experiencing an electrical shock. And a similar characteristic, let me drop. Back in my youth, I experienced a similar characteristic where a good friend of mine, K2RJB was his call letter at the time, K2RJB and K2RIW, built themselves a code practice oscillator, sent Morse code back and forth to each other, learned the code, got the license, and so on. But Rob, K2RJB, built himself a Tesla coil. What was unique about the Tesla coil by modern standards is that it had something like an 807 tube in it. The tube was oscillating at, I'm not sure the exact frequency, but something like 150 kilohertz. So instead of a spark gap fed Tesla coil, this was a tube oscillator fed Tesla coil. So it ran at a continuous something like 150 kilohertz, made out of the high voltage terminal out of this Tesla coil. I think we were getting sparks of about 2-3 inches long. Let me drop. You could hold your hand in front of that spark, see the spark jump from the terminal of the Tesla coil over to your fingers or over to your hand, and you almost couldn't feel it because the frequency was so high, 150 kilohertz approximately was my memory. This thing would, by skin effect, all of the current was flowing on your skin, none of it was penetrating the finger, and you didn't feel the current flow of that spark gap. And so I am guessing that the high-frequency components of the arcing and sparking and whatever on this light bulb circuit is some of the explanation as to why a person can put his fingers there and not feel a large amount of discomfort, electrical discharge across his finger discomfort. So the good news is that I think we've got a partial explanation for what's taking place. The bad news is that to now evaluate the amount of power, the amount of energy per time being subjected to the light bulb is not easy. When you've got a waveform that is that discontinuous, that spiky, that high voltage-y, that's got very large periodic, extremely large DVDTs, change of voltage versus time, to evaluate the amount of power contained in that waveform, which is a instantaneous product of voltage and current with the inclusion of the phase angle between the voltage and the current, to try to evaluate the amount of energy per time that the light bulb is absorbing from this very nonlinear circuit is, of course, not easy. Now, you're getting an immediate indication by way of the amount of illumination coming out of the light bulb. Let me drop. So the amount of illumination coming out of the light bulb is giving you a hint about the amount of energy. I mean, if a light bulb is giving you, let me pick a number, 100 watts worth of equivalent illumination, or would you take a 100 watt light bulb and you look at how much light comes out of it, and you take a look at this particular light bulb and you figure out how much light is coming out of it, you get an indication. But even that, you got to be a little bit careful with it, because is the light that we're seeing, is every bit of it a thermal emission of the incandescent filament, or is some of the 90-volt spikes ionizing the gas that's inside of the incandescent light bulb? Every incandescent light bulb contains a small amount of low-pressure gas, and that gas, with a high enough voltage, is capable of being ionized, and it gives off an entirely different emission. You can hold a light bulb up against a Tesla coil, where it's arcing over to one terminal of the light bulb, and you will see illumination coming out of the light bulb. It looks different, but you're ionizing the gas. And so how much of that is taking place is an interesting question, and by various measurement techniques, I think we will eventually resolve that using filters in front of a camera, by taking pictures of a camera with two light bulbs side by side, one fed with a 60-cycle variac and the other one fed by this more elaborate circuit, and comparing the illumination, and by way of filtering, and by way of measuring temperature of the light bulb surface with thermocouples, with and without filters, we eventually will resolve where is the energy coming from, what kind of energy is it. I'm not sure now who wants to speak. I guess, Wesley, you probably do. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One quick comment.
Go ahead, John.
Wesley has available to him, which I believe he's purchased, are vacuum bulbs with no inert gas in them. I think he has those on the way, so you can check with him about that. That will be interesting.
So I think you're saying Wes is proposing to substitute the current light bulb with a pure vacuum light bulb, and that's a bit unusual because the reason why most incandescent bulbs contain a small amount of inert gas is so as to slow down the rate at which the tungsten boils off. A pure vacuum bulb probably has a much shorter life because the tungsten without the inert gas is continuously boiling off, and therefore the tungsten filament is subject to failure in a much smaller number of hours of operation. I wonder if the manufacturer says anything along these lines. Back to you, John.
That I don't know. Maybe Wesley has that information, but that's about it. Pick it up with Wes, and let's see where this goes. KC2WGB.
So it sounds like you've ordered some vacuum incandescent light bulbs. I'm kind of curious. Is that a European product, an American product, or both? N2XJM, K2RIW.
There's a video from the 60s about Dr. Peter Letterman that we've been talking about for quite a time, and I've seen that video that they were using light bulbs without a gas in it. I didn't purchase it yet. I'm trying to acquire it right now, and this is like a very old product. And my question to you, we go further since we are that subject, is how about halogen lights? What do you think about that? Because the spacing between the ends of the contacts is much larger.
My understanding of a halogen light is that it is an incandescent bulb that runs at a much higher than normal filament temperature, and the halogen gas inside is able to control the heat sinking of that filament and the rate at which tungsten or whatever it is boils off. So a halogen light, I think, is shorter in wavelength, higher in temperature, more blue, and I guess some of them might even have phosphor somewhere that converts some of the ultraviolet light coming out of a halogen bulb into a more visible light. But to my knowledge, a halogen light really contains a larger amount of high-pressure halogen gas, and that might it might complicate a little bit what I'm talking about. I'm a little bit concerned about what percentage of the light out of the bulb is gas ionization light as opposed to pure incandescent filament temperature light. N2XJN, K2RIW.
It's a good question. N2XJN. At the first experiment that we provided, we started from zero. Three people, international group, and that's how everything started. We were able to first light up the bulb of 60 watts, which was the regular incandescent light bulb. Then we switched to 150 watts. That was first experiment. And we were at that time very much excited. I believe I sent the link to you. And it was working. Then we switched to 600 watts, and that was halogen. And it was working. So 2 weeks later, we decided that we going to have another approach, and that was a yoke from the old TV. Over there, we were able to reach about 1 kilowatt driven from two small generators with the spark up. But if we didn't apply the spark up, it was 150 watts. So then I decided that I'm going to go to Lithuania, and there was a group of six people, four people constantly, 20 hours a day, 21 hours a day, 3 hours for sleep for 5 days. And because we've got a problem with the oscillators that were going, the ferrite from the yoke was magnetizing somehow itself, and the sub-resonance frequency.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What about it? So start to work on the Caduceus coil. At first, we approach the Caduceus coil with the regular pickup coil, and the regular pickup coil is the coil that is on the top of the Caduceus coil that is at the same length what the Caduceus coil is, and you stick about 5 meters of wire. Actually, it will be 10 meters of wire. You bend them in half to have two wires together. You start winding from the middle of the coil, and one wire go to the left, one wire to go to the right at the same direction. So, question for you before I go further. We could not say that this is a bifilar because it's not a bifilar structure. How would you call that structure?
I would call it a structure that has, starting at the so-called short circuit end, the right-hand side, it makes a spiral clockwise winding and a spiral counterclockwise winding. And each winding crosses in two places. It crosses on the top and on the bottom where the clockwise wire meets the counterclockwise, a pair of wires. So it's a pair of wires, clockwise, pair of wires, counterclockwise. And I would call it a spiral winding, a helical-like winding. So it's a helical-like winding, spread out of quite a bit more than a helix normally is, but still an unusual kind of winding, which excites that coil, excites the ferrite rod if it's there, but it is exciting the large number of conventional solenoid windings that are, I believe, underneath the spiral winding. Spiral winding? Helical winding. I'm going to call it there's a right-hand helix and a left-hand helix. So the right-hand helix and the left-hand helix are insulated but lie on top of the many turns of solenoid winding, which is the real high-voltage winding. Is that approximately the way you see it, Wes? H-U-R-I-W?
Intuition. Well, at first we have a first piece of pipe, which would be the pipe that has a Caduceus coil on it. Then on the top of it, that could be another pipe, or could be simply an insulation. And on the top of that insulation, which we use actually the scotch tape, the heavy duty scotch tape for the parcels, for it, that was working beautiful. Then we wind that winding, that is a pickup coil. Pickup coil has three ends. One of these ends will never be used. So if we start winding from the middle of the coil to the right, and from the middle coil to the left, and we have a three ends, which will be the center part, top, and the left and right hand side. One of them, I use the word counterpoise, but actually it's a balance. And without that balance, simply the device doesn't work. There's another statute of limitation, ferrite. The ferrite could be tiny, thinny. Without it, doesn't work. So I have developed a theory which actually, if you look at the diagram with the coil capacitor, you see the Caduceus coil with the cross points between the winds. So you have a one winding on the caduceus coil with very wide thread going to the end and then coming back in the reverse direction. You have a cross sections of those wires. We called the two important points of these cross sections P1 and P2. Now we put the ferrite with the approximate length from P1 to P2. The ferrite then has the permeability of 2000. So we know that the permeability of air is 1. We know that the amplification factor is 2000. Do you agree with that, Dick?
With your permission, I'd like to go back and ask a more basic question. I can see the so-called wound capacitor inductor-like device made out of foil that's on the diagram that John quite often calls the crayon diagram. If I look at the neat diagram that has the red sawtooth waveform, the neat diagram is that elaborate coil capacitor foil thing. Is it shown on the neat diagram? Is that C4? Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, I didn't know about that diagram, neat diagram, but I can do it right now. The diagram actually relates to a pickup coil. So the only difference between the neat diagram and the crayon diagram is that we use a different means for gathering the energy. One, the neat diagram use the coil that I call pickup coil with three ends, and the other one use the capacitor one. So yes, the C4, although I didn't open up that, will be the one that will be replaced by... Oh, no, actually it's not. The C4, I'm sorry. C4 is the capacitor that is across the pickup coil. That's what is named pickup coil, is either the pickup coil or in the crayon drawing is a coil capacitor. Back to you.
Okay, the coil capacitor has two leads coming out of it that are called leads number one. It has two leads coming out of it that are called leads number two. When I go over to the neat diagram, there are no lead numbers, so I don't get a correlation there. Is the word pickup coil, ferrite rod, 0.4 millimeter diameter, and then under that it says pickup coil. Is the pickup coil the thing that has a pair of number one leads and a pair of number two leads? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
No, the pickup coil is the coil that I just described. That we take 10 meters of wire, we bend them together, and we wind one to the left, one to the right. That's the pickup coil. So we either have a pickup coil on the top of caduceus coil, or we either have the coil capacitor that has two light bulbs and four ends. Back to you.
Don't forget the ground.
The coil capacitor made out of foil, does it exist somewhere on the neat diagram? Over to you.
No, it does not. The reason for that was because we didn't have any way for the people to understand how coil capacitor works if we did not have a crayon drawing, sort of tri-dimensional, showing exactly the structure. Do you agree with that?
I think I do. Now let me ask another very basic question. When I'm looking at the neat diagram, the upper left-hand transformer has input leads number 1 and 3, has a grounded lead number 9 and 10, has an output lead number 11. does that look like a caduceus coil, or the so-called pickup coil in the lower left-hand corner, does that look like a caduceus coil? Does either one of those, when I see it physically, look like a caduceus coil? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Don't forget the ground.
N2XJN. No, the transformer, 3-1, 9, 10, 11, it's a regular flyback transformer from the old TV. The reason that I ask Glenn to wind for me the transformer that will give me ability to have a waveform that is undistorted was because I want to completely replace flyback transformer to the point of 11 and deliver to the point 11 a high voltage of 10,000 volts with controllable waveform on it. The caduceus coil is the one that is on the left-hand side at the bottom and is being marked on the neat diagram, CDS, and underneath of it uses, you see the description, caduceus marked as CDS.
Okay, so the lower left-hand diagram transformer, which has got a primary winding, a secondary winding. The secondary winding has three connections. One of the connections is not used. Middle and bottom is used. Top is not used. And it's got a black object which looks like the ferrite rod.
Correct.
So that is a caduceus coil, is what I think you're saying.
Yes and no. The caduceus coil is on the left-hand side. Has only two ends. Then you have in the middle the ferrite rod. On the right-hand side, you have a pickup coil, the ordinary pickup coil with three leads on it. Back to you.
Verification, Dick.
You got it, Charles.
Dick, the transformer you're looking at on the left, that's a combination of the caduceus coil and the output coil. The black thing is the ferrite rod, which is inside the left coil. That's the caduceus coil. The coil that's on the right side of the ferrite is a coaxial sleeve that goes over the caduceus, so now you have an idea. And don't try to relate diagram one with two. They're two different diagrams.
The only common point for it is, for both of them, starting from point 11, two diodes, C2 capacitor, the spark gap number one, and caduceus, in both of them, stays the same. And also the ferrite. The rest of it is different. The high voltage transformer that we have used, which is 9, 10, 11, and 3, and 1, it still exists, but it's going to be replaced by the transformer, Glenn transformer. Let's call it Glenn transformer. Now, the major difference. Between the connection to the right-hand side of the nice diagram, between pickup coil and coil capacitor is that in a pickup coil, we must have diode D3, capacitor C4, secondary spark gap, which is being called spark gap number 2, and a light bulb. In coil capacitor, if you switch to the coil capacitor, to the Creon drawing, you see that coil capacitor has four ends, two light bulbs, where one of the windings of the coil capacitor, and you can describe that so Bernie would be able to understand it, is connected directly to the light bulb through the spark gap, and that sleeve that is slided between coil capacitor and the caduceus. There is an option, second option, that is light underneath of the lower light bulb, which actually represents a similar approach with the diode and capacitor and the light bulb to the one that was in neat drawing. And to exchange.
Comments
Junction.
Wesley, keep your answers brief. He's asking specifics. Please just answer the thing yes or no, and then let him ask the next question, because the Inquisition will go on forever. Just take it one step at a time. I know what you want to do, but let Dick lead. Back to you, Dick.
I'm getting the impression that the circuit has at least two and possibly three different versions. One version has a coil capacitor feeding a light bulb and a spark gap and that CL3 curved capacitor plate against the caduceus coil. I'm going to call that version number one. Another version of that is the light bulb is replaced with another light bulb with a capacitor and diode. And the third version is the so-called Neat diagram, which is neither of the first two, which has something called pickup coil. By the way, does pickup coil have a lot more turns than the CDS coil? And so that network of diode, capacitor, spark gap, and light bulb looks like that could be circuit number three. I think there's three different working circuits here. Pickup coil has how many turns compared to CDS? Or how many turns is on the pickup coil, roughly, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
I would say that we have only two versions. One version is a Neat diagram with the pickup coil, and the other one is Creon, the drawing. That is with the coil capacitor. I'm counting right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 23, 24, 25. So the pickup coil has a center top and 25 winds to the right and 25 winds to the left.
Okay. On that version with pickup coil, the Neat diagram, the CDS side on the left side, how many turns are on that winding?
Oh boy. 1, 2, 3, I believe. That depends because the angle is especially alternated. The angle of crossing is not that if you draw the line from the left to the right-hand side, you don't have all crosses at the same place. From one side, yes. From the other side, no. That was by the process of experimentation. We took the caduceus based on the theory. And theory came from Nikola Tesla. There is very little information on the net about the caduceus coil. It didn't work. So, 1, 2, 3. I see the three cross sections that are important to us, being on in line, one line, if you draw the horizontal line.
Yeah, if I start off with one of the output leads of the caduceus coil and follow it continuously, it winds down to the base and then continues back toward the top again. It looks like a total of three turns. So I think we're talking about three turns on the primary total and 25 plus 25 turns on the secondary. 50 turns total on the secondary, but 25 of those turns appear not to be used. It is a floating resonator is a good guess. And by the way, of the 25 turns that are used and the 25 turns that are not used, I was about to ask, are they in the same direction? It might not matter. The direction of the turns that are not terminated might not matter, though I did think you said starting at the center tap of the pickup coil, 25 turns to the right, 25 turns to the left. When you say left and right, are you speaking of physical displacement to the left and the right of center, or are you talking about left and right meaning clockwise and counterclockwise turns? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, good question. No, just the direction, horizontal direction. You have a horizontally placed piece of pipe. And the pipe has the length, I'm taking the measure right now, and I'm trying to measure that. is about 10 inches in the original one. 10 inches, and the diameter of the pipe is approximately 3 inches. The center of this horizontally placed pipe is approximately 5 inches. Starting from the center, you take two wires. You leave about 4 inches, 5 inches in your hand. Then you start to wind the wire from the top to the bottom to the left, and from the top to the bottom to the right. And yes, extremely important, if you happen to wind the wire to the right-hand side, where the end that was never used, and you write, and you wind that part in the direction that you usually wind the winding, so the winding would be like in one direction, it wouldn't work. You gotta have to have half of that, the right half of that coil that is left alone, not connected, to be following the rule. So again, you take two wires from the top to the bottom to the left, winding, and from the top to the bottom to the right. Back to you.
Okay. The portion of the pickup coil that looks in the diagram, the neat diagram, like a center tap, and it's connected to C4 and the light bulb, and the bottom of that pickup coil goes directly to diode D3. Is that particular winding one piece of wire or two pieces of wire running parallel? Over to you, Wes.
No, it's a one piece of wire. Basically, if you start from C4 on the top, that's the center top of the pickup coil. At that point, yes, you're dealing with two wires together because we started from that point. But then left and right, we have only one wire. So maybe you would be able to describe that better.
Okay, to understand it, you took a length of wire, folded it in two, so that you've got a 180-degree joint in your left hand and two wires going over to your right hand. You hold on to that folded joint, and that's going to become the center tap. One of those two wires you're going to wind clockwise, and it's going to go down to D3. The other one of those wires from your left hand, you're going to wind counterclockwise, and it's going to become the upper end of the pickup coil, and it's going to be unterminated. Is that approximately true? Is that what you mean by two wires? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
That is correct. It's like the springs, because they look like it's a spring. The wires are a little bit apart, the distance from each one to each other. And then it's like we take two springs that are winded in different directions, and we slide them on the pipe and connect these two ends, the middle end.
You got it, John.
Dick, what I think Wesley's trying to say is, you're right, if we took that length of wire and folded it, now we have something like a closed U. We lay that on a table. We take that pipe, we put it at right angle, at the bottom of the U, and we just wind it like it's a rolling pin. That will give you the winding that he's talking about.
Right. Okay, in that case, then, the upper portion of the coil is wound in the opposite direction from the lower portion of the coil.
Yeah, it's like you put that wire, you have a horizontal pipe lying on the table. You put these two wires, you put them at the center, but the wires are on the top of the coil. Now, what you're trying to do is, starting from the top of the coil, wind one from the top to the bottom, top to the bottom, in the left direction. The other one would be from the top to the bottom, top to the bottom, in the right direction.
Yeah, I think I got it a little bit clearer in what John said, where you hold the wire in half, the bottom of the U, you could tape it to the piece of PVC pipe. You got two wires at right angles coming away from the pipe, laying on the table. Now you roll the pipe.